Daniel chapter 1. God's word reads like this. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king?" Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chiefs of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. This is God's word. What a thrilling chapter. Before I set up a little backdrop here, let me take 3 or 4 just initial observations from you. What's your initial reaction from the text? Anything stand out to you as interesting, as reminiscent of something else, something you want to know a little bit more information about, anything like that? Helen?
They chose the best.
Okay, so the king chose people of the nobility, the muckety mucks of Judah, right? The somebodies. Very good. What else? Yeah.
Oh, verse 9, where it says, "And God gave Daniel favor."
Yeah.
It reminds me of Joseph's story. How God is with Joseph
and yeah.
Blessed.
Yep. Very good. Yep. So that's Genesis 37, right? 37, is that when he's in jail, or is that 39? One of those two chapters, 39, I think. And it says that essentially whatever Joseph set his hand to, he succeeded because God was with him, right? He showed Joseph favor. And so we see...
He was in a similar situation, right? So like Joseph was sold into slavery and now these guys are in captivity.
That's right. So. Very good. Excellent parallel. And this idea of receiving favor, that word favor is the word for grace. So they received grace from the Lord, right? Or he did, these four, rather. Anything else? 1 or 2 others, and then I'll move. Anything else strike you?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that resolved.
Okay, very good. Yeah. There was a resolution made. There was a determination made by Daniel, right? A godly determination. Very good. Very good. So important that God's people don't just passively react to things that are happening to them, but rather they make determinations, godly resolutions, right? Are you able to turn the heat down just a little bit in here? Is it on at all?
I'll turn on the air conditioning.
Would you? I'm like melting up here. Thanks. Okay. Okay, so have any of you ever been whitewater rafting? You ever been okay?
Just my kids.
Okay. Anybody on the set? Billy, you ever been on a whitewater paddle for your life? Rocks ahead of you? You know? Yeah. Kelly reminded him. Okay. So I remember this one time, ill-advised, me and Courtney and I took the college and career-age folks whitewater rafting. I had no business leading this trip. I regret it to this very moment. So we went down to West Virginia, the New River, I believe. So there's different spots where you're supposed to pull off because they're going to like help you with lunch or, you know, whatever. And if you miss that pull off, you are toast, because the force of the river pushing you, like, it, in other words, if you don't pull right in where you're supposed to, you know, land that raft, you are like fighting for your life just to make a few steps back in that direction. And that is not unlike the force of the godless society that we live in, pushing against us. Trying to get us to bend to the, you know, the curve of this world's river, if you will. And that's what we're looking at in this chapter. We're looking at Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, that have sacked Jerusalem and taken up some of these important figures and transplanted them, right? Taking them captive, ripped from their homes, and plopped into a new society. And with all kinds of pressures for them to become Babylonian, right? So in 722 BC, the northern kingdom of Israel had been defeated by the Assyrians, and they had been carried off into exile because of their unfaithfulness to God. And while Judah was spared that fate at that time, God's wrath for her disobedience would not be staved off forever. And so the Assyrian Empire, the world power that had taken the northern kingdom, they would be replaced eventually by the Babylonians. That was in 612 BC. Shortly thereafter, they would come against Jerusalem in several different waves. Second Chronicles 34, I think we looked there last week, but just be reminded, this is verse 24 of that chapter. Behold, I will bring disaster upon this place and upon its inhabitants, all the curses that are written in the book that was read before the king of Judah, because they have forsaken me and have made offerings to other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore, my wrath will be poured out on this place and will not be quenched. In other words, God moved through the Babylonians to punish, to discipline the southern kingdom for their disobedience. So the book of Daniel covers a very large sweep of Judah's history. It includes their mass deportation eventually, the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC, and their some 70 years in exile. And this is chapter one. This is the first installment of the message of this prophet to the exiles. And in bringing about his certain plans for human history, remember, God predicted this was going to happen. So he has purposes in every stage of human history. In this stage, we see God overruling earthly powers that are pressing on his people to compromise their faith. So that pressure, like the river I mentioned, right? The rapids, you know, pushing you down the river, that was the pressure of Babylon. And yet in this text, we see God overruling that pressure. If you could imagine a river being stopped up so his people could traverse without any difficulty, much like Joshua's day coming into the land. Well, anyway, based on that, I've set the theme of this chapter one being this. I have written it for you. To be useful in this godless culture means remembering who you are. It means remembering who you are. But I mentioned there's this powerful pressure, and that's really what verses 1 through 7 are all about. You tell me what pressures you see in these first 7 verses that would be pressing against these youths, these 4, Daniel and his 3 friends, right? What would pressure them to abandon their identity in God? What do you see in the text? Anything? Let's go one at a time. Did you have something, Millie?
He changes their name.
Okay, so they've got new names. They've got strange-sounding names. Strange to them, but not to anybody else there, right?
I think those names are relative to the names of their God.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Helen?
A new language.
Yeah, that's right. Where do you see that?
Verse 4.
Well, 4 is... Yep, thank you. End of 4, yep. Teach the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Very good. So they're getting new names. They're getting, like, the history and literature teaching about that culture. Anything else? Yeah, the king's food from the king's table. His food, the food he eats, the wine he drinks. Anything else?
The temple relics are trivialized. They're taken out of the temple and put in the king's museum or his house.
Yeah. Yeah, you see that up in verse, 2? He brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Right? What vessels? The holy vessels of God's temple in Jerusalem, taken as trophies, right? So now, not only do these 4 have new names, and they're being taught a new culture, and they have new food put before them, food that is foreign to them, and now also they're seeing what was precious to them, part of the worship of Yahweh, is now being transported into the treasury of Babylon, right? Let's see here. You guys caught so much. That's so good. Okay. So the king had exerted on God's people to this pressure to conform to the Babylonian way of life. He was trying to do something. He was trying to accomplish something. He was trying to fold in the people that he had conquered into his people. So there would not be a distinction. I mean, think about that. The very purpose of God creating a people for his own name from the barren Abraham and Sarah right down to this day. All of the regulations for worship, all of the annual feasts and the food restrictions and the rules with respect to how you deal in business with others within Israel, all of those things were distinct, right down to the fact that they were monotheistic, that they only worshipped the God of the Bible, the creator of heaven and earth. And Nebuchadnezzar, he was dead set on stamping that identity out of them, right? He was trying to force the people of God to forget that they were the people of God, forget who they were. And this is seen through all the things that he commanded concerning them. You guys have listed a number of those things. But it's also hinted at, even in Daniel's usage of the phrase, the land of Shinar there. Did you catch that in verse 2? I read that. Every time I read it, I can't remember what that word means. And I'm like, why is that being said like that? That's not the normal name for Babylon. Well, this was the ancient name for that place. It's used, for instance, in Genesis 11, where godless men built a tower in order to create a name that was apart from God, right? That's the place that the Tower of Babel was built. And so it's a head fake. It's an illusion that Daniel makes back to that day. People trying to have an identity that is divorced from the God who made them. But in the end, with all of these pressures, there's really sort of an emphasis on the food, isn't there? I mean, you've got this this fellow that's kind of afraid for his life if he doesn't make sure this comes to pass, right? As Millie suggested, these new Babylonian names kind of ties a bow on the whole identity pressure. One commentator explained the rationale for the renaming. He said it this way. The name Daniel means Elohim is my judge. Elohim is the Hebrew name for God, of course. The name Belteshazzar means this: may Bel protect his life. Bel being one of the Babylonian gods. So, and that's sort of the point. This identity would be tried to be stamped out of these conquered people. So we see in this first part of the story an enduring truth that this godless world will use its power to pressure people to conform to its beliefs. I mean, can I get a witness? Right? I mean, do you feel that pressure? You feel the pressure of this world trying to cause you to forget who you are, who you belong to, what your calling is? I mean, give me an example or two. What pressure do you feel or do you sense happening right now in this age that would cause you to forget your identity as being gods? Can you think of one?
The Islamists do not allow anyone to defame the name of Allah. And if we do or speak against him, we are guilty of death. But they...
You mean if we were in a Muslim country?
Well, it's going to happen here. Yeah. Let's talk of it.
So the pressure that comes from a another religion, right? That's going to have teeth to it if you don't recognize it, something like that. We're good. Well, is that something else?
Yeah. Accepting people muddling gender identity when it's defined in the Bible of how God has created man and woman.
Yeah.
But the world wants us just to accept people how they want to be.
Yeah.
Which is contrary to what God says.
Yeah. In other words, our identity is rooted in being made in God's image, purposefully and beautifully, and also remade in Christ. Right? So our origins, if you will, right, form the basis of our identity, right? And this world is trying, as you said, muddy that whole idea, that identity is a fluid thing. If I just want to be something else, I just declare it to be that kind of thing and abandon the person God made me. Yeah, for sure we have that pressure. Bill, did you have some?
Yeah, I don't know if this happens to anyone else, but Sunday morning, I like to stop at Dunkin' on my way here, and I'm in my Sunday best, right? Sometimes Kelly and I have stopped at, I think it's Biff's or something like that, for breakfast on the way to church, right? And enough of the time it happens, I'll see people that I know, and they're in their sweats or jammies or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And we look at each other, and like I'm reminded that I'm different than they are, and I'm sure they're looking like, who does he think he is, or something, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Every now and again, there's an exchange like that. It happens often enough. It's like Sundays, are different for us. You know?
Yeah. Well, and employers, no longer relent of scheduling Christians on, say, Sunday mornings or I mean, the days of Wednesday nights being off limits for sporting events and things like that, those are, that's long gone, right? Yeah, very good. Was there a hand over here somewhere? Yeah, Millie?
Well, there's a push to destroy free speech. But I recall before I retired from Detroit Diesel, Daimler-Benz had bought us out.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to write a policy of diversity,
mm-hmm.
which we had to sign if we were going to be employed by them. And I remember thinking that I was glad I was retiring,
mm.
because I'm sure as a Christian, I would often would not want to comply or agree with their diversity
policy. Yeah, so employment policies, right? Trying to push people into... affirming worldly beliefs about people's identity and religions and things like that. That's true. Well, certainly Daniel and his friends felt that pressure. But as I think Sue pointed out, we also see this middle section of the text really showing this righteous resistance over against this sort of onslaught of royal edicts. And Babylonian brainwashing, Daniel refused to yield. It's a courageous thing. It's an admirable thing. He was resolved to take his stand against these intense forces of worldly compromise. And as Millie suggests, that you know a lot of these pressures maybe we feel on an informal basis, right? But those formal pressures seem to be in the works, and if we know anything about biblical prophecy that we have at the end of the New Testament, there is going to be a day when if you don't bow down to this godless society, you won't be permitted to engage in commerce, which is at the very, you know, sort of ground floor of our society, of purchasing things that you need to live, things like that. You know, Revelation talks about taking the name or the number of the beast, and we don't want to over-literalize that, like it's going to be a literal tattoo or something. But the idea here is that there will be this strong force, this official force, that says, if you don't bend the knee to what this world says, you're not going to be able to even get food to live, perhaps, houses to live in, these sorts of things. But over against that, Daniel drew the line. Look at verse 8 there. Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Now, we don't have any details about what the king's food was. I mean, we could do a bunch of historical backdrop kind of work and maybe guess at what it might be. But in the end, we don't really know. All we know is that for Daniel, it would be sin, right? He would defile himself. It's suggestive that perhaps the food might have violated some dietary restriction from the law of Moses. That's the assumption. But the thing that we want to just really sort of land on is that Daniel had determined that he was not going to do anything that would cause him to be impure, that would impede his worship of Yahweh. Most believe Daniel was a teenager at this point, which is pretty incredible when you think about it. Consider a few things about this very thing. Young people are being pressured to compromise what they believe today in schools, certainly in their first workplaces, things like that. Before they've had time to sort of build up the strength of their faith, those sorts of things. Young people are precious members of God's family. They're used in significant ways, and the world is trying to take a swipe at that again and again. And despite the fact that Daniel was powerless, though, God gives us this example of how to have courageous faith in the face of this incredible wicked force that's in this world. So what was the godless ways of the world against which Daniel was taking his stand? Well, as I've said, it was essentially to let go of what the pressure was for him to let go of what he believed about what would please God, or the flip side of the coin, what would cause God to be displeased. You know, this sort of thing. I mean, notice how Daniel approaches this problem. He didn't flip tables over. He didn't just go around loudly complaining about his situation. He didn't try to physically attack those that had been placed over him. I mean, look at what the text says here in verse 8. It's really pretty incredible. Look at the second half of the verse. Are your eyes on it? He asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. I mean, that is a very particular turn of a phrase, right? He asked if he would be allowed, if they would permit him not to defile himself. I mean, I'm convinced that we sort of hear the echo of like Romans 13 in this passage, you know, to submit yourself to the governing authorities, no matter how godless they are. Remember how, you know, bad their, you know, aims are for you and the regulations that they place upon you. He humbly approaches the person that God has put over him in the situation. Remember, God predicted this and brought it to pass. And all of these little interactions are God's doings, right? And so Daniel asks him if he could simply live according to his conscience. And friends, I wonder in our day, if now, I'm not talking about emergency room doctors. I'm not talking about people that work in emergency fields to protect people, like policemen on duty on Sunday mornings or firefighters and EMT drivers and the like. I'm just talking about the regular run-of-the-mill kind of jobs that will irritate Christians by scheduling them, say, on a Sunday morning, or cause them to wear something that would be offensive to their beliefs or something like that. And I'm convinced that if we took this approach, I'm not saying it would work out the same way every time, but I'm convinced that if we would honor God by respecting the people he's put over us and simply asking them their permission, that we might live according to God's standards, I'm convinced that many, many times God would grant grace in that sort of situation. But I think a lot of times we're just afraid to ask. I think we're afraid that it is this insurmountable thing we're up against. And while I don't think that's the main teaching of the text, I think that's something to consider. Notice that the text says nothing of what Daniel expected would happen when he did that. Did you see that? There's no like, you know, we don't have an editorial comment here that's like, Daniel had a word from the Lord. He knew it was going to work. Like, none of that sort of stuff, right? He had no guarantee that his faithfulness would not bring him harsh punishment, even death. At the mere suggestion of refusing to obey the king's commands. And we need to be aware of that as well, right? We are, time and again in this world, we will suffer injustices simply for trying to be God's man, God's woman. Allegiance to God is inherently risky, in other words. In fact, it usually puts you squarely in harm's way. I mean, recall Jesus' words in John 15, 19. If you were of the world, the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. That's just our marching orders. That's the banner that's flown for those that would follow Jesus. Now, the chief of the eunuchs could have made real trouble for Daniel, but God had other plans. And so we see in verse 9 this beautiful phrase that I think Courtney pointed out. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. You see, friends, God works in the hearts and minds, right? The decision-making of everyone, not just his people. He is the ruler of all of creation. and everybody filled in it, right? And so we need to be more courageous, not because we think every time we draw a line in the sand, we're not going to, you know, suffer some kind of harm for obeying God, but we need to do it because we believe that God's the king, not only of us, he certainly is that, but he's the king over everybody. And if it's in his good pleasure to cause some wicked ruler to grant us peace, to grant us permission to live according to God's good rules, then that's exactly what's going to go down. I mean, to have somebody that's fearful for their own life at the mere suggestion that the king's will not be followed completely, right? For that person to have that fear turn into pity, compassion for God's people, this is nothing short of miraculous. This is God's grace, undeserved. It's unable to be produced by people, but God is a God rich in mercy, full of grace, and does this sort of thing all the time. The steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, verse 11, right, that he was approached, and finally the steward listened to them in the matter and tested them for 10 days, verse 14. Who knows what God would do if we would remain steadfast, persistent before powerful people who oppose our beliefs? Who knows? Who knows what might happen? Well, the amazing conclusion of these events and these final verses is that obstacles, threats, pressure, all of it's overruled. Overruled by God. Despite powerful foes and certain failure of Daniel's decision, I mean, it's certain, right? I mean, listen, I've been dieting since July 1st, okay? Nobody looks at me and says, that's a guy that's happy and healthy, the very best to be in the kit. No, I may, you know, I have friends that tell me, like, we want you to start eating again so Happy Jeff will return. I mean, this is incredible that God's good plans for his people, even when we can't really think how it might be possible, they always come to pass. His good plans for his people always come to pass. It doesn't matter what kind of worldly forces try to oppose it. Despite only eating vegetables for 10 days, the young men, verse 15, were better in appearance and fatter in flesh, I can witness, than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. I mean, it's really incredible. Not only that, not only the food thing, but also remember they were getting pounded into them the teaching about the Babylonian literature and culture and their history and their way of living and all of the sort of thing. Despite their lack of upbringing in Judah and their unfamiliarity with Babylonian language and literature and all this, at the end of their 3 years of training, sustained only by their paltry diet, this was the result. Verse 19, you see it? I mean, this is some strong language here. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. You see all those universal descriptors? Anything the king asked them about, they were experts. It didn't matter if they stood up against, you know, 20-year veterans, the king's, you know, sort of right-hand man, famous magicians and wise men and enchanters. They were all kind of in the same category because their worldly wisdom was seen in reading, you know, signs and things like that. And we might think in terms of like crystal balls and that kind of thing, right? But God's men that stayed faithful to him, 10 times better in wisdom. And so God made them useful in this exile. It's really quite amazing. It starts here, but this will sustain through this book. In fact, the text concludes by telling us God would use Daniel in this way for 60 more years. Did the last line there. Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So over this long sweep of decades, God had plans to make his people useful. I mean, despite Nebuchadnezzar commanding everyone to force these youth to conform, to abandon their beliefs, to compromise their faith, we read that God gave Daniel favor in the eyes of his overseers, verse 9 and 14. God made his faithful vegetarians to remain fat and healthy and bright, and God caused Nebuchadnezzar himself to judge them as worthy of bringing him counsel in his royal court. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. This is how God overcomes obstacles. He just orders it so. He just makes happen what he wants to happen. Like, you know, he overrules like our normal, you know, eating function, our diets and things like that. He overrules, you know, ornery kings. He changes the hearts of people who are fearful of the king and letting his people do according to their consciences before God. We're called to live like that. We're called to live under that pattern of understanding of our world. I mean, Peter tells us to be holy as God is holy. Hebrews tells us to live by faith as strangers here, knowing that we're citizens of heaven because of our faith. Well, this is a call, if you will, to paddle upstream. It's hard. It's risky, right? The current of this wicked world is strong. The obstacles against our faithfulness are hard to navigate around, but who knows how God might employ us in this world. Perhaps we would even stand before judges and policymakers and really important people. Who knows how God might use us in this wicked world to bring about his good purposes? 60 years he used Daniel. It's incredible when you think about it. And even as you turn the pages of Daniel, you're going to see different kings come to power. And yet, God's man, steady, right there. Wait, we know a guy that interprets dreams, also like Joseph. Right? So it's really an incredible chapter. So that's the big idea I want you to walk away from this text with. To be useful in this godless culture means remembering who you are. If we'd only do that, God be praised. I hope that's a blessing to you.